It's an honor to be here today. Just a warning, I have a cough drop in. And if I get excited, it may fly out. I just pray it doesn't put anybody's eye out. This morning, I want you to take a journey with me. And you'll probably wonder at some point what it has to do with you. But I want you to hang in there, because toward the end, I'm going to connect the dots. See, I grew up in southeastern Kentucky, near a town called Hazard. There was 9 kids in our home. I was number 8 of number 9. When I was brought home from the hospital, I was brought home to a 3-room shack with an outdoor toilet. Life was hard. My dad was an abusive alcoholic, and my mother was afraid. When several years after I was brought home from the hospital, we had 2 rooms built onto our shack and a bathroom. Running water is wonderful. We take it for granted, but it's wonderful. When my dad would get drunk, he would wave out around the gun, shoot it in the air, and we would run for our lives. We slept in barns. We slept out in the woods. We slept on people's porches. When I was little, I was about 4 years old, my dad whooped me so hard my legs were covered with blood, all the while telling me I need to learn a lesson. I didn't know what that lesson was, but I still have the tiny scars on my legs to remind me. One of my earliest memories was when I was 4 years old. My dad was drunk. At that time, there was 8 of us home. My little sister had not been born yet. He got out the gun, he started waving it around, and he said, "I'm going to kill you." And we all start running. Our yard in front had an embankment that went down toward the road, and there was a footpath that went over to the left. We ran out the door. The older ones went over the embankment. I was little. I went to the footpath by myself. I'll never forget the stabs of fear that ran through my body and the trees that were hit above my head as he was shooting, the crackling. And when I hit the edge of the end of the footpath, there was this huge boulder at the end. And I heard a bullet glance off that boulder. When I got to the end of the footpath, my sisters was screaming, "Hurry, hurry, hurry." And as I got to the end of the footpath, I just fell forward. And my brother grabbed me and slung me on his back, and we ran. As we was running, we was about a 1/4 of a mile away from the house. He couldn't see us no longer, and it started to rain. My brother put me down. He peeled the shirt off his body. He handed it to me, and he said, "Cover up." And he slung me back on his back. I put the shirt over my back and over my head, and I looked through that tiny opening from the shirt, and I could see lightning go across the sky, and the rain hit my face, and I was terrified. I can still see that in my mind today. We went to the neighbor's house who lived about a mile down the road, and she felt so sorry for us, she let us sleep on her porch because everybody was afraid. So the next day, we got up, we went back home, and it was never to be mentioned. Fast forward. When I was in the 3rd grade, I had this teacher named Miss Wooten, and she was strict. You know, when you was in trouble, you'd get that look. You know that look mothers give that looks like they're like trying to use the bathroom or they got a sour pickle? You know that look? Well, one day she gave me that look and she called me out in the hallway. And I thought, "Oh, Lord, what did I do? I don't know what I done. Maybe I cussed," because we cuss at home and sometimes I forget that we're not supposed to cuss at school. But I don't think I did it today, so I don't know what I'm in trouble for. So I walked outside. You know, she called me outside out in the hallway, and I said, "What did it do?" And she said, "Nothing." And she pulled out behind her back a paper bag. And she handed it to me, and she said, "Open it." And so I opened it and looked in, and it looked to be clothes. So I pulled the first one out, and I pulled it out of the bag, and it was a beautiful blue dress. It had gold around the sleeves, gold down the front, gold around. Absolutely beautiful. And she said, go ahead. And so I reached down and I pulled up some material that was really soft and it was really crimson color. It looked like the rose bush at the bottom of the yard at the house. And I pulled it out and it was the most beautiful dress I'd ever seen. It was red velvet, had rhinestones in the front, and gathered at the waist, and was just breathtaking. And I looked up at her because I was like, okay. She goes, take it home. It'll be our little secret. So I put them back in the bag, and I went back in the classroom, looked like I was in trouble. See, I didn't want people to know. So I get on the bus, and I'm heading home, and I get nervous. I get sick at my stomach because I didn't know what my dad was going to do. He could whoop me. He could cut them in pieces. He could burn them. He could let me keep them but not let me wear them because that's the kind of dad I had. And so I get home, and I walk in the front door, and my mom's sitting at the kitchen table, and I show her the beautiful dresses. And while I'm doing that, I hear him mumbling like, we don't need no charity. She whispers something in his ear. She goes and whispers something in his ear. She comes back, you can keep the dresses. And I did. Every time they were washed, I wore them. Till they were so obscene, I couldn't wear them anymore. They got a little too short after a while. But that was a huge day for me. You see, I knew I was poor. I knew that that I had holes in my shoes and I had holes in my dresses. But I didn't really think about other people knew I was poor. That they saw who I really was. That was a huge moment for me. Now, there was times that there was these two ladies would come and visit us and ask us questions. And our dad says, you don't tell them anything. And you don't go to school and you don't tell them the truth. Because if you do, I'm going to kill you, everyone. I'm going to start with your mother. Now, I didn't know till I was a little bit older that these were social workers. And we were lying to social workers. But we were threatened. Move forward a little bit down the road. When I was 16, I came home from school. And all the older brothers and sisters, they were ran off or they left because nobody really wanted to live in this house. So my little sister and I were left, and we came home from school. And, of course, my dad was drunk, and my mother was babysitting him. And I am coming in, and I'm fixing us something to eat. Now, the stove is, say, right here. And my mom and dad's bedroom door frame was just about this far from the stove. This is the door frame. And about 4 feet from that door frame is the foot of my parents' bed. So I'm at the stove, and I hear this yelp from my mother. And when I turned around, I see my dad bring a pistol up, and he says, I'm going to kill you. You know when they say that time stands still when something really serious happens like this? It does. It seemed like an eternity. I mean, do I run and let him shoot me in the back? I mean, it was different this time. He wasn't waving it in the air. He was pointing it directly at my head. Or do I stand and let him shoot me in the face? I had to make that decision. And he cocked the pistol. And I stood. You know, I thought, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I can't run anymore. I've had enough. So I wait. And I see my mother reach up with both hands and shove the pistol down. And it goes off. The bullet lands in front of my feet. And she screams, run. And so I grab my little sister, and we run toward the woods. And we wait. My mother broke free, and we wait. And he passed out. The next morning, we come home from out of the woods, and it was never to be mentioned. I mean, how can you not mention? I looked down the barrel of a gun, and a man said he was going to kill me. How can that not be mentioned? But it was never supposed to be mentioned. Few days later, maybe a week, I decided, all right, if he's trying to get rid of me, maybe I should get rid of him first. Us mountain women, we got a backbone. And it's pretty thick. So he went out to make a vodka run. And he loved buttermilk. He loved buttermilk. And none of us would drink it. So there was about a cup of buttermilk in the cart and left in the refrigerator. And he was gone. So I knew he had heart trouble and emphysema. And so I get his medicine, and I pull capsules apart, put it in the buttermilk. I crush the pills, put them in the buttermilk. I'm pretty proud of myself at this point. Because I may get rid of somebody we've been trying to get rid of a long time ago. He comes in, he drinks the buttermilk, throws the carton in the garbage, and I wait. And I wait. And I wait. You can't kill Satan. I can tell you that right now. You can't kill him. I tried. Didn't even make him sick. Wasn't over. Not long after that, he passed out on the kitchen floor. I got a butcher knife. I kneeled down over him. And I thought, one blow to the chest, it's done. Nobody won't have to run. We won't have to sleep in the woods. I raise it up. And my mom snuck up behind me and grabbed it out of my hand. She said, he's not worth it. He's not worth it. I had to agree, he wasn't worth anything. So after I graduated high school, I got a job downtown. And part of the deal was he would let me drive his car if I would help pay for the insurance. Long story short, I came home from work one day. I go in my bedroom, and there's a quilt tied in a big knot with clothes in it in my on my bed. And then I realized it was every piece of clothing I'd had was on inside that quilt tied up. He walked up behind me and he said, get out. You're on your own. You don't belong here anymore. I was devastated. I was devastated. So I walked across the creek to my sister's house because we didn't have a phone, and I called my boyfriend and I said, will you come and get me? I don't have anywhere to go. And so he came and got me. Long story short, we ended up moving in together. And then he lost his job. And then he let me move in next to his parents' trailer in a shack. In a shack. This was a shack of plywood, a twin bed, a freezer, and a sink with running water, but only cold water. It was cold. It was cold in there. Nobody wanted me. I was homeless. I had nothing but the clothes that I could carry around with me. I mean, literally, I hit rock bottom. And so I stood on my feet, and I saved the money, and I got an apartment of my own. And it felt good. But there was one thing I didn't realize was even though I had my own place, my dad still controlled me. Because he had instilled this fear in my mind. I had nightmares. I'd wake up screaming. Most of the nightmares were him actually killing me. I could not get away from this man. You see, I hated this man with every being in me. I hated his guts. And I hated my mother because she stood by and she let it happen. I had a lot of health issues. I had migraines, heart issues. Couldn't afford to go to the doctor. I was broke. You see, I had enough money to pay my rent and to pay my phone bill, which I needed for work because I needed all the hours I could get. If he called me in on my day off, I went. I walked to work. But I ran out of money about mid-month. I got paid once a month. And during the day, I could buy food at work. There was a pharmacy in the back, which I worked in. That front was a restaurant. And I could get my meals during the day half price. And I only needed really one meal a day. But the weekends were pretty hard, especially when I ran out of money about mid-month. Now, I didn't know about food. Nobody told me about any of this stuff. So I starved. I would take those little wrapped salad crackers from work, and I would bring them home with me over the weekend, and I would break them up in little pieces, and each little piece I'd drink a full glass of water so that I wouldn't have hunger pains. You see, for some reason, I thought when I was an adult, I would not have hunger pains like I did when I was 4 or 5 years old because we were poor. But here I was, an adult, having hunger pains. Now, let me put this in perspective. I was 19 years old, and I weighed 85 pounds. That's 35 or 40 pounds less than what I weigh now. I'm a chunky monkey right now. My waist wasn't this big. I was starving. And the nightmares. So when I was 19, it's a long story, but I tried to commit suicide. Because I was so tired. I mean, I wasn't running from him, but yeah, in my mind, I was still running from him. And the hate, oh my gosh, the hate I had in me. The bitterness I had in me. So I met this guy, and he asked me to marry him. And so we were looking for a church to get married in, and it was suggested we check out Hazard Christian Church there in Hazard. And so we started visiting there. And then we got married, and we kept going. And they were talking about this man named Jesus. Jesus. I'd heard his name before. My dad had said that there ain't no such thing as Jesus and God. There ain't no such thing. And you know, I agreed with him growing up because why would God let a monster treat children like this? Innocent children like this? I'm like, I don't believe that stuff. But I went and I listened. And he said, the preacher said, Jesus loves you. He will meet you right where you are. He will never forsake you. He will change your life. So one day I said, okay, let me see what you got. Because see, I had already tried to commit murder. I had done everything in the world. All those commandments, I had really broke them. I was crawling in the ditch of life, and I was sick of it. I said, come on, Jesus, show me what you got. And so I started reading the Bible, and he did show me what he's got. And one of the first things he showed me was to love your enemies. I said, oh, I can't do that. Oh, yeah, girl, I forgave you, and you got to forgive him. It don't work on this one-way street. You got to do it. And I was like, God, I don't know that I can't. You don't understand. I hate this man, but I love you. I love you. You have to do this. So slowly but surely, God changed my heart. Every time that bitterness would rise up, you got to forgive, girl. It's eating you alive. And so I did the best I could. And it was not always easy. And it sometimes my mouth, that backbone came out. And I said things I shouldn't have said. And I would have to ask God to forgive me over and over and over. I mean, it's like he had to shine a flashlight in those dark places of my heart and say, give it up, give it up. So I was 21 years old when I became a Christian. That's against statistics. You're not supposed to get saved at that old age. But I was 21, and I was a child of God who was falling on her knees all the time, asking God to take away the bitterness and to forgive. So the following year, my sister was at my mom's house visiting, and she lived in Letcher County, and I lived in Perry County on this side. So we didn't get to see each other very much, And she called me and she said, I'm up at Mom's. Why don't you come up? I'd like to see you. And I had, you know, I'd been up to my mom and dad's house. I'd take them Christmas gifts and stuff like that because I was trying. I was trying to mend this. And so I went up there and I walked in. My sister hugged me. I went over to the stove, and my mom was at the stove, and I looked, and she had green beans with new potatoes, cornbread, and fried apples. Is that not delicious? I said, oh, I can't wait till you're done, because I don't eat much anymore. And so I turn, and my dad is laying in bed, and he's mumbling stuff. And I said, what's wrong with him? And my mom goes, oh, he's just acting a fool. He's been like that all morning. And so I walked into the bedroom, and I looked down, and he was a pale blue color. His eyes was looking straight ahead, and there was a white foam around his mouth. And I yelled at my sister. I said, go get the blood pressure cuff. And she brought it, and his blood pressure was bottomed out. And I screamed, if we don't get him to the hospital, he's going to die. And my mom was like, no, ain't nothing wrong with him. I said, we don't get him to the hospital, he's going to die. So we rush him to the hospital. I'm driving like crazy. We get him to the hospital. They take him to ER, and we're in the waiting room. And they come out, and they said, if you had waited an hour, he would have been dead. He only has one lung that functions, and it's full of infection. I saved his life. I felt like I was kicked in the stomach because this is the man I'd hated all my life. But then again, I was not the same creature. God got a hold of me and he changed it. So they put him in ICU and they said the next 24 hours is critical. We don't know if he's going to make it. So I went in the ICU room where he was at, and I saw all the monitors and the beeping heart and the tube down his neck, and he was helpless in front of me. It was so strange because most of my life I'd seen this dad of mine who was always out to get me and hurt me. And here he was, helpless before me. So I took his hand. I sat down and I took his hand. And I realized, this is the hand that whooped me, beat me. This is the hand that shot at me. This is the hand that wrapped a belt around my mother's neck and pulled it tight until she passed out and then let go of it. I'd always hated this hand. But when I took his hand into mine this time, I begged God to let him live. Because there was one thing I wanted him to have, and that was Jesus. I wanted him to have Jesus. So I prayed and I prayed. And so a few days later, he got a little bit better, and they put him in a regular room. And my husband and I led him to the Lord. This man that I'd hated all my life was now a child of God. And they took the tubes out and he was talking. And the difference was amazing. He would reach for me when I would come into the room and ask me to pray for him. He would ask me to read to him out of the Bible. My dad had a third grade education. The difference was amazing. I mean, this man that I butted heads with, we were in the same accord. You're talking about a wild thing going on. That's wild. So one night, I went to his room. And most of the family, we were staying about every night there because the nurses was on strike. They were shorthanded. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And he asked me to read out of the Bible. And I was reading Ephesians. And I was reading in chapter 3 about how wide, how high, and how deep God's love is. And when I got finished reading it, he was asleep. I closed the Bible, and I reached over, and I kissed him on the forehead, and I said, I love you, Dad. I love you, Dad. Now let me back up a little bit. Those words were never spoken in our home. Our parents never said they loved us. Those words were never spoken. And I was shocked because you know why? I knew that God had set me free. He had set me free. Forgiveness, bitterness, and I was free. I was free. So I went home. I'd only been home a couple hours, and my sister called. And she said that the hospital called and wanted us to come back in, that he'd gotten worse. And she said, you're the closest to the hospital. Go on to the hospital, and we'll meet you there. I knew it was over. I went to the hospital, and I went into the room, and I wept, and I prayed, and I waited for his chest to rise and fall, and it didn't. But my comfort was he was God's. He was in God's hands. Now let me fast forward a little bit. I moved to Frankfort, and I became a part-time youth minister in 1996. Loved the job. And then in 1998, I got a job with the school system. And I did both jobs for 2 years. And then in 2000, I decided that I could no longer do part-time. You know, part-time's not really part-time when you're a youth minister, because those 3 o'clock morning phone calls. So in 2000, I said, I can't do both these anymore, so I'm going to have to work full-time for the school system. So now I can tell you, I've been working with youth for over 20 years. I've worked with students with disabilities. I was a vocational trainer. And about 11 years ago, I got the job. It's kind of like a Frizz Family Resource Youth Service Center, except it's board funded, and it was called Student Support Specialists. And then this past January, we got the funding from the state, and it's called Youth Service Center. But I've been doing this job, this particular job, 11 years, and working with youths over 20. So you may be wonder why I tell you this story on a day that we're honoring people who do human service jobs. Let me tell you, you who do that jobs, I kind of know what you do every day. I know what a tough job you have. I know the battles that you battle all the time. Not particularly all the details, but I understand the heartbreak. And I want to share some of those with you. Several years ago, I got a call from the police. Some of the girls I'd worked with were involved in human trafficking. People, it happens in our neighborhoods. It happens right under our nose. You're just lucky enough not to see it. So I worked with those girls, and we got them out of the trafficking, and they got help. One of my girls, which I'd worked with for several years, she had missed a week and a half of school. Now, I'd already been told by one of my police officer friends, I work really close with the police, that she was pulled out of a hotel with a bunch of meth heads. And she hadn't been to school in a week and a half. So I went looking for her. I'd been working with this girl for years. Now, her dad was a drug dealer. Her mother lived in South Carolina, was a meth head and a prostitute. Poor child didn't have a snowball chance. So anyway, she found out I was looking for her, and I get a call from her dad. Her dad's at the courthouse. He calls me, and he says, come and get her before I kill her. I said, I'll be right there. So I go to the courthouse, and she's in the court-designated worker's office. He said, do something with her. I said, okay. I'm going to take her home with me. You're not to have any contact with her until I tell you you can. He said, okay. So I take her home with me. I walk her 2 miles on my farm to get her system, get that stuff, some of that stuff out of her system. Fixed her supper and made her go take a shower. And I had to help her brush her hair because it was nothing but mats. And when she came back down, we went through her backpack. I found Dybeck needles and lingerie. You know, in the inside, she was 15 years old. She was selling her body for drugs. And on the inside, I just wanted to cry. I mean, I was crying on the inside, but I had to be tough to her face. See, social welfare, you have to put on that face. Even though sometimes inside you just want to scream. So I took her to school every day for several days, got her caught up on her work, made sure she was clean, she was fed, and then I called her dad and I said, we're going to take her to treatment. And so we took her and got her into treatment. Another situation. One of the girls I worked with for several years, she was living with her grandmother. She had been since she was like 4. Her mother was a drug addict and a prostitute. When she was in 8th grade, her mother got clean and she got custody of her again. So it was fine for a while. They had an apartment. And then time went on, and her mother was staying gone for days at a time, drinking binges 10 days at a time, and they were evicted. So they went to the Simon House, which is a shelter for women and children, and they were there. And I told my student, I said, I was close with her. I said, you know, why don't you just come and stay with me? Ask your mom if you can just come and stay with me until she gets another place to live and she gets her, you know, gets it together. She said, no, Miss Betty, she's really trying, and I don't want to discourage her. I just want to try to uplift her. I said, okay. So mom was kicked out along with the kids out of the Simon House because she kept smoking pot. She got caught 3 times. She got kicked out. And they went to stay with one of her friends, her mother's friends. While they was at the mother's friends, they'd only been there a couple weeks. They had this big party. And everybody gets drunk, including my student. She gets drunk. And she gets sick. And she goes lay down in the bed. And a guy there at that party comes in and rapes her. I thought my head would explode. I don't get this. I thought I would explode. I'd worked so hard. And this had to happen. I mean, these are just some of the stories. I had 2 of my students who got drunk on vodka and took Xanaxes and died and was brought back. One of them twice. And they were kids I worked with on a daily basis. I had 2 students who had a dad who overdosed 7 times on heroin in an 8-month period. And 2 of those times, he gave him the shot to bring him back. And I had a hard time getting him to come to school because he was afraid to leave his dad because he was afraid that nobody would be there to give him the Narcan and he would die. I mean, homeless kids, I've taken a couple of homeless kids. One was living in a Jeep with his parents. I said, you can't stay with me, but he can. I mean, these are some of the stories that us who work with human services and professionals, mental health, this is what we deal with. Church, this is what they deal with. And it's hard. These are just a few stories. So I'm going to talk about compassion fatigue. Now you see why people has compassion fatigue. There's a cost to caring. Professionals who listen to stories of fear, pain, and suffering, they take that on and they feel that. It's a hard thing. We're vulnerable to it. This includes emergency care workers, counselors, mental health professionals, medical professionals, clergy, advocate volunteers, human service workers. Compassion fatigue is the emotional residue of exposure to working with the suffering, especially those who work with those who have had traumatic events. It's a tough job. Not only do they have to deal with normal stress of work, you know, and the daily stress of life, they have to deal with this compassion fatigue. Now, there are signs of compassion fatigue. Weight loss, headaches, emotional exhaustion, chronic pain, and the one I deal with a lot is sleeplessness. How can you treat it? Well, if you can afford to go to a therapist, go. At least have somebody to talk to. Take vacations, journal, meditate. When I get home and it's warm outside, I head straight toward my hammock and I watch the clouds go by. Because I got to unwind that head of mine. It's going fast. Find something you're passionate about and focus on that. Sing, dance. Lay down and rest without thinking about your job. I know it's hard. But the most important I think I do is I pray. I pray. And you have to take care of yourself because, workers, if you can't take care of yourself, you can't take care of anybody else. You can't. Now, I want to speak some scripture and then I'm going to connect the dots. Proverbs 31:8, speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly. Defend the rights of the poor and the needy. Isaiah 1:17, learn to do right. Seek justice. Defend the oppressed. Take up the cause of the fatherless. Plead the case of the widow. In James 1:27, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after the orphans and the widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. Now let me connect the dots. Keep standing up for those who need to be stood up for. Keep fighting the cause for the needy and the oppressed and the widows. But when you think your head is going to explode, you got to remember, God may have a different plan. You see, the reason I told you all this is I wasn't pulled out of the home. God had a different plan for my life. He didn't waste any of it. He used every bit of it. I mean, when my dad got saved, I don't know if I'd not been there. Most of my family are Christians now. And it started with me. And who knew I would end up working with youth? When a kid comes in and said, "You don't understand, Miss Betty," I said, "Try me." Oh, I don't know what it's like to starve. I don't know what it's like to get the daylight slapped out of you. And it's worked wonderful. God did not waste a moment of that. But I want you to remember, you got to take care of yourself. God has a plan. You keep fighting. And you remember, God's in control, not you. And the things you don't understand, He does. He sees way far ahead than you do. But you still got to take care of yourself. You got to take care of yourself or you can't take care of those people. See, today is a day about this church showing you that they appreciate everything that you do. They appreciate everything you do. You're out on those lines fighting every day to make a difference in lives. God sees it, and other people sees it, but today they want to show you, and please do. In closing, I want to read you this in Ephesians 16:13-18. Therefore, put on the full armor of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you've done everything, to stand. Stand firm, then, with a belt of truth buckled around your waist, with a breastplate of righteousness in place, and with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to all this, take up the shield of faith with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of the God. And pray in the Spirit on all occasions, with all kinds of prayers and requests. With this in mind, be alert and always keep on praying for all the Lord's people. So this being said, social welfare people, please stand one more time. It won't kill you. Just stand one more time. Church, these people are on the front lines for our future. They're on the front lines making a difference every day. What I want you to do as a church, I want you to eye these people out. And after the service is over today, I want you to go shake their hand, hug their neck, give them an encouraging word, get their name, put it on a prayer list, and continue praying for them. They need your prayers every day. I want to thank you for the time that you've given me, and I hope to see you at the banquet after. Thank you.